Come, come whoever you are, come as you are, come with the things we know of you and the parts we do not yet know. Bring with you what is yours this week, a fearful or a heavy heart, a joyous song, a weary spirit or a seeking mind. Bring the gift of yourself to this place and know you are accepted fully and unconditionally, that you are indeed a gift to this community. Come knowing that this is not a place of despair, not a place where judgment and fear are preached, but a place of hope and of the love that casts out fear and supports you on your journey. Come, come whoever you are and join in this ongoing creation of the beloved community. As Rick Lent and Sharon Brownfield light our chalice, I invite you to join in the unison words of chalice lighting by Samuel Longfellow this morning, printed in your order of service. Hope lights her fadeless fires. Faith shines on with steadfast ray. Love, the flame that courage re-inspires as morning stars lead on the way. And as Michelle Cote, our Director of Religious Education, comes forward to share a message, I want to tell you a little bit of what happened at the first service this morning. We had the end of our first chalice program. You know, in this church, we often recognize milestones, from child dedications for our very young to our youth with coming-of-age program and OWL. But for those kids in the middle, those younger children who each week come and explore this faith and learn things about it, there's been no ceremony, no rite of passage to mark their progress. So to that end, this year we started this first chalice program where grades 2 and 3 study and learn and have to demonstrate that they've learned certain things about Unitarian Universalism and engaged in activities that teach them the values of our faith. And when they do that, when they complete that, they're recognized with a chalice. You see some of those little chalices, those were all given out to quite a few. I don't remember how many there were, 9 maybe?
12
in total, okay. And 9 of them were here to be recognized today, I think. And so I want to thank Michelle Cote and Jolene Sullivan, who were the principal creators of it. It's really very important, for our children to be affirmed in our faith at that age. I actually met with them in their class a few weeks ago and was really impressed with their questions, and it was just a joy to see this new piece added to our community. And now, for a message for all ages, Michelle.
Good morning. So today Tom's going to be speaking on the message of fear, and I have a children's message from a book called The Fabulous Flying Fandinis, and I did share this book a couple of years ago, and it's one of my favorites. And the message, I can use it in different ways for messages, but the message today is to really think, especially as a teen or a preteen, you face a lot of situations where you're afraid to do something because someone might judge you, or you're afraid to try something new, and that one goes for many adults as well, because you're afraid of failing. And this is a book about a little boy named Bobby, and it was written by Ingrid Slider. Once there was a boy named Bobby who lived in a neighborhood where everyone did the same thing day after day after day. Bobby was okay with this, but didn't like that there weren't any friends in his neighborhood to play with. Well, one day the strangest thing ever happened. The Fabulous Flying Fandinis moved into Bobby's neighborhood. They painted their house lots of colors right away and put up pennant flags with their name on it all over the house, and they had an elephant in the front yard. The neighbors all said they were very strange. "Strange house," said Mr. Smith. "Strange pets," said Mrs. Jones. Well, Bobby Brown happened to live just 2 doors down. "The Fandinis are friendly folks," said his mom. "With lots of children to play with," said his dad. "Why don't you go play?" "No way. Forget it," said Bobby. "They could be strange, have cooties, or worse." His dad left and said, "Go on, go see." So Bobby went to the Fandinis and knocked on the door. Mrs. Fandini answered the door in her ballet tutu. "Come in, come in," she said with a smile. Inside, the house had no doors, nor stairs, nor walls, only trapezes. Trapezes full of fabulous flying Fandinis. "Jump on, join in," the children cried as they whizzed above Bobby's head. "No way," said Bobby. "I might get a nosebleed, a blister, or worse." And when it was evening, the Fandinis mounted their elephant and walked Bobby home. "So tell us," said his mom, "did you try something fun?" "So tell us," said his dad, "did the Fandinis teach you something new?" "No way," said Bobby. The next morning, the Fandinis rode a horse to the grocery store, and Mrs. Fandini held the groceries in her hand as she stood on her horse. All the neighbors shook their heads and said, "They are a strange family. That is not the way people bring home groceries." But Bobby decided to go back to their house again that morning. This time, Mr. Fandini answered the door with a lion at his side. A tattooed lady served pancakes on the trampoline. "Jump on! Join in!" the children cried. "Not today," said Bobby. "I might get queasy, lose a tooth, or much worse." And that evening, the Fandinis mounted their unicycles and pulled Bobby home in a wagon. "Did you join in today?" asked his dad. "No way," said Bobby. "I might not like it." The next day, the Fandinis trimmed their trees on stilts, and the neighbors again said, "How strange." But Bobby went back again. This time, the Fandinis were hanging laundry on their clothesline while walking on the line like tightrope walkers. "Jump on, join in," said all the children again as they hung their socks on the line. "Ah, gee," said Bobby, "I might get the hiccups or something much, much, much worse." "Why not try something fun? Why not try something new?" asked Mrs. Fandini. Bobby looked down at his shoes, and at last he confessed in a whisper, "I might look stupid, and someone may make fun of me." The Fandinis all spoke up at once. "Not if we show you how. Just ask. Come on," they told him, "hold our hands." And with a friend holding tight to his left and his right, Bobby jumped on and Bobby jumped in, and he walked that tightrope, even though he saw the neighbors looking at him, and he knew they were saying, "How strange." And that night, Bobby went home by way of Canaan.
Shall cross the barren desert, but you shall not die of thirst. You shall wander far in safety, though you do not know the way. You shall speak your words in foreign lands, and all will understand. You shall see the face of God and live. Be not afraid. I go before you always. Come, follow me, and I will give you rest. If you pass through raging waters, in the sea you shall not drown. If you walk amid the burning flames, you shall not be harmed. If you stand before the power of hell and death is at your side,
am with you through it all. Be not afraid. I go before you always. Come, follow me, and I will give you rest. Blessed are the poor, for the kingdom shall be theirs. Blessed are you that weep and mourn, for one day you shall laugh. And if wicked tongues insult and hate you, all because of me, blessed, blessed are you.
For the past many years, especially I think since the September 11th attack of 2001, all of us have experienced a heightened sense of fear. Our lives changed in a way that we had not expected. An innocence was lost. And in a matter of weeks, metal detectors and luggage and body searches were part of our lives. Perhaps by now we've become almost used to these. But ever since that day, our lives have again and again been punctuated with events that can instill fear in us. With the recent marathon bombing and the subsequent lockdown of Boston and surrounding towns, and before that, the Newtown shooting, most of us have experienced some fear. Of course, we know that in other parts of the world, people live in great fear of just this sort of thing all the time. But surely not here in this country. Well, the French thinker and international relations expert, Dominique Moisy, claims that we in the West, meaning Europe and the United States particularly, now actually live in a culture of fear. He sees this fear not just in isolated places or with certain groups of people, but as an overriding emotional trait of our culture. Moreover, he sees this as a profound shift from a culture of confidence and hope that existed after World War II. If he's right, which I think he probably is, we must consider the effect of that this fear is having upon us. It's not the first time in our nation's history that fear has been a defining characteristic of our society. It was on March 4th, 1933, in response to the severe economic depression, and at a time when evil ideologies were taking hold in Europe, a new president taking the oath of office spoke these words to the nation. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It has a nice ring to it, and it did certainly inspire people at the time. But it's not true. In our time, just as it was in Roosevelt's time, there are certainly more things to fear than just fear itself. But that statement makes the point that it is the fear itself that can have very negative effects in our society. In difficult times, fear spreads fast, and sometimes fear can become a greater concern than the underlying issue that causes the fear in the first place. The poet Charles Simic wrote, "Fear passes from man to man unknowing, as one leaf passes its shudder to another. All at once, the whole tree is trembling, and there is no sign of wind." Fear itself can become the problem, rather than the thing of which we are afraid. What Roosevelt was preaching was that fear itself is the fundamental danger, but if we can get beyond its debilitating effects, we can handle the underlying problems. Fear, however, does not only innocently spread from person to person in a bad situation. It also can be intentionally propagated. Fear can be used as a weapon. Perhaps what happened in Boston, with that we can begin to get some idea of what it would be like just to be an average person in Iraq or Afghanistan, where every day innocent people just going about their daily lives get blown up by terrorists. Terrorists succeed not by conquering with force, but by paralyzing people with fear. Fear is their greatest weapon. But fear is not just used by terrorists. It's used in more subtle ways by political leaders and campaigners for your vote or your support. It feels to me that so much of our politics over the past few years has been based on fear. Since the 9/11 tragedy, it has been fear for our safety that has allowed our government to hold people indefinitely in jails and pass laws that infringe on even the most basic of civil rights. And although I personally am a strong supporter of gun control, it seems to me that both sides in the gun debate are fueled by fear. You know, we don't want guns easily available because we fear for the safety of our children, or we want guns available so we can protect ourselves against the bad guys who we fear and who already have them anyway. It's fear. Today I want to examine with you the role that fear plays in our lives as individuals, as a community, and as a nation. If it's true that fear is increasingly dominating our lives, as Moisey says, is there an antidote or any way to move beyond our fears and reconnect with more positive forces like hope and trust and faith? All of us live with fears, and they play an important role in how we lead our lives. As little children, we learn to be afraid of the traffic or the hot stove or other dangerous situations. We know teaching children to have appropriate fear responses to certain situations is a way to protect them. On the other hand, we have all known the parent that overprotects a child. I was with someone not long ago who, with every move her child made while playing, blatted out another warning. "Don't climb on that. You'll fall and get hurt. Don't touch that. There are germs on it. Chew your food carefully or you're going to choke." I don't think this overprotective behavior made that child any safer, but I'm pretty sure that over time that it does create a frightened adult. Youth and adults also need a certain amount of healthy fear. Reasonable fears cause us not to take unreasonable risks or act in reckless manners. You know, we drive our car in a certain way. We lock our doors. We walk on the sidewalk and not in the middle of the traffic. These essentially are fear-based responses, but appropriate for our well-being. And the opposite's true as well. We all have tragic stories of friends who were hurt or hurt others because they did not adequately perceive a danger and took an unreasonable risk. Sometimes fear protects us and can even help motivate and inspire us. Maybe I've belabored this, but the point is that not all fear is bad, and we actually need a certain amount of fear just to survive. But this morning, I'm not focusing on the good kind of fear, but instead on the destructive fear, the fear that holds us back as individuals and as a community, the fear that can steal our minds and cause us to make poor decisions in our own lives and even in the collective life of a nation. There's a lot of fear in our society right now. We're afraid of lots of things, losing our jobs, students who won't get jobs. We're afraid of that our retirement isn't secure, that Social Security won't be there. We're afraid of terrorists who might attack or might strike a large public event or target a school. Students are afraid to go to school, and some parents are afraid to send their children. We're even fearful, perhaps, to drive through a tunnel or over a bridge, fearing that it might collapse, as we've seen. All the fears that our society now instills in us are compounded by our even more personal fears. We fear getting old, losing our independence. We fear illness. We fear moving on to the next stage of our lives. We fear loneliness. We may even fear intimacy. We fear that we can't keep up with the world that's moving faster or that what life expects of us. We fear changes in our lives, in our community, even in our church. Sometimes we may even fear our own success, for it will result in things being a bit different too. And who knows what other quirky little personal fears each of us has. I've always known that I am not comfortable in tight spaces, but several years ago I learned how claustrophobic I really am when my doctor sent me for an MRI. When I saw that machine and they were going to put me in it, I was panic-struck. I knew there was no way I could stay in it for even a few minutes, much less the 45 minutes that the procedure required. I ended up driving halfway across the state of Massachusetts to get my test done in a much larger machine with open sides, and even then it was barely bearable. At an intellectual level, my fear makes no sense to me. And I have to say I feel, or I felt then, embarrassed that I couldn't just go through the simple and painless test. But I couldn't. We have no shortage of fears. None of us are immune to fear. But what we do with those fears, how we respond to them, will have a great impact on the quality of our lives. And I think there are at least three responses that I believe we can have to fear. First, we can try denial. Some of you have met my now 7-year-old niece, Morgan. Morgan, a few years ago, went through an intense princess phase. And at that time, she was absolutely fascinated and fixated on the story of Snow White. She loved that DVD and watched it over and over again. And we'd watch it together. But when the witch appeared, she quickly blocked her eyes and yelled, "Uncle Tom, fast forward past the witch." She was afraid to watch the witch. And that was her way of dealing with that fear. It is the proverbial ostrich approach of putting your head in the sand so you can't see what it is that you fear and thereby convince yourself that it's gone away. Many of us, young, old, and in between, often try this route, at least maybe first. Denial at times can be our first response to fear, such as maybe when we receive a difficult medical diagnosis or when we should be seeing the handwriting on the wall at a place of employment or a school. We can pretend that there's nothing to fear and even fool ourselves, at least for a short time. On the other hand, we can become so consumed by our fears that they block our mind from thinking of anything else. And that leads to the second response to fear, and that is seeking safety at any price. In this approach, nothing else matters. Not our beliefs, not our values, not other people. Nothing. On the personal level, it can be taking every conceivable precaution, maybe never leaving your home because it's unsafe to do that in the extreme, or trying every treatment or cure that has ever been suggested for any particular disease or condition. On a national level, I believe that fear-based decision-making has taken us to some very troubling places. You see, when fear is the basis for our decision-making, we will exclude many other important considerations. Careful considerations of the effects of our actions tend to be lacking when fear is the impulse. The 18th century philosopher Edmund Burke recognized the debilitating power that fear has on rational decision-making when he wrote, "No passion so effectually robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear does." It seems to me that we've gone through a period of fear-based decision-making. How else could you justify the adoption of a preemptive war strategy other than as a result of fear-based decision-making? There's no other way to understand the enactment of some of the extreme provisions in the Patriot Act that have deprived individuals of fundamental rights with little or no evidence to justify such an intrusion, but it's fear-based decision-making. It's fear that I think has led to actions that are not consistent with whom we really are as individuals and as a nation. Only in a culture dominated by fear would people who know in their hearts that torture is always wrong, and we do know that, turn the other way when our government engages in it or when we send people to other countries to be tortured. Only in a culture dominated by fear would we allow people to be held for years and years in prison in violation of every fundamental legal right without any due process. If all we think about is safety, letting our fears rule the day, we will soon lose the high moral principles and beliefs that really define who we are. Of course, safety is important, and it's one of the duties of our government to provide for our safety. But as James Carroll wrote a few years ago, a longing for safety can be carried too far, and such a wish can be unworthily exploited by government. When fear so dominates our lives such that safety becomes our only concern, we make bad decisions. This is true in our life as a nation, our life as a community, and in our personal lives. But there is a third possible response to our fear, quite different from either denying it or being totally consumed by it. It is one of engagement with our fear and then transcending it. We're able to do this by connecting with a deeper and even more powerful force than fear. And essentially, this is a religious response to fear. You know, the connection between fear and faith or fear and religion is an ancient one. Some religions are actually based on fear. Their response to fear would fall in the category of safety at all cost. But ours and many other faiths are not that way at all. Instead of manipulating us with fear, they provide us with tools and encouragement to face our fears. You know, fundamentalists like to distort the essence of our Western religious tradition by describing us as God-fearing people. And although there certainly are references in both Christian and Hebrew scripture to fearing the Lord, Rabbi Mark Gelman says that the commandment you hear most, and it's the commandment that you heard Mike sing earlier, "Be not afraid," is the most frequently repeated command in both the Hebrew and the Christian scripture. It appears, for you trivia folks, 122 times in the Hebrew Bible and another couple of hundred times in the Christian Testament. Be not afraid. The voice saying "be not afraid" comes to those biblical figures in times just like ours when fears are taking control. It comes in supernatural ways and it comes in ordinary ways, but it always does pretty much the same thing. First, it acknowledges the fear, speaks its name, looks it in the face, and then that voice reminds us that there is something better, something greater within us with which we can meet that fear. As that beautiful anthem you heard the choir sing earlier reminds us, there's a voice inside of us saying, to the hills I'll lift mine eyes, and I'm not afraid. That's the religious response. When your heart is full of fear, focus on higher things, values, principles, the things that all faiths actually teach. Especially in times of fear and despair, there's a voice inside of us that speaks from a place of love and hope. There's always something more to those biblical stories that are about engaging our fears. Often after God's voice or the voice of some angel tells the fearful biblical character to be not afraid, it goes on to say, and you heard Mike sing this, I am with you. I suggest to you, no matter what you believe about the existence or power of a God, that statement is true for you. The I may be your neighbor, the person sitting next to you right now. It may be your inner strength and courage. It may be the force of love and justice. It may be God. However you see things, there is a countervailing presence in you that is ready to meet the fears that can overwhelm us. It is the voice that says, the fears are real, but you can transcend them. Living in these times of many fears is a spiritual challenge to us all. And transcending our fears is a spiritual journey we all need to travel. How we deal with our fears is probably the single largest factor in determining the quality of our spiritual life. Sometimes engaging our fears seems like an impossible undertaking, but we can do so, not alone, but supported by other spiritual travelers and by the faith and trust we have in forces that are greater than our fears. The price of either ignoring our fears or letting them rule our lives is just too high. We must engage them, but not let them control us. We have something to learn from our fears, but we cannot allow them to paralyze us or cause us to take actions that are unwise or inconsistent with our best selves. I began this sermon with words from one great Roosevelt, and we'll conclude with words from another. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, you gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. The purpose of life, after all, is to live it, to taste the experience to the utmost, to reach out eagerly and without fear to a newer and richer experience. That's what our future can hold. May it be so for each of us, for this community, for our nation, and for the world.